I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Courtney White. He is author of the new book, Grass, Soil, Hope, A Journey Through Carbon Country, and he will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore this Sunday, the 24th of August at 11 in the morning. It's part of the Journey Santa Fe series. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Good to talk with you again.
Great to talk with you, as always. Now, your life has had such an interesting trajectory. You were very much an urban boy. You were an environmentalist. You then found yourself a cattle rancher. You co-founded the Kivira Coalition, which is all about bringing environmentalism and ranching and farming together. And we've heard about your work. The Kivira Coalition is going strong today. You've stepped down from your position as executive director, although you're still involved. They do amazing conferences every year. Now you are working on carbon and right. soil specifically. How right. did this come to be?
Well, it's kind of a logical outgrowth of where we started and what I've been working on, but I just had never thought about carbon before. As you say, we worked with cattle ranchers and environmentalists, public lands managers and scientists for many years, trying to improve stewardship, improve land health. We've done a lot of creek restoration. We've talked about these things over the years. We ran a ranch ourselves for a while up on Roe Mesa outside near the Pecos area. Got into grass-fed food production as a consequence. So it was really quite a journey for me growing up in the suburbs of Phoenix, Arizona, of all places. And then one day in the summer of 2009, I was sent a publication that I opened up called Mitigating Climate Change Through Food and Land Use. And I thought, well, this is interesting. And we hadn't thought a lot about kind of the climate questions, and we had lots of other things to worry about and think about. But I opened up the book, and I looked at it, and the five bullets that said how to mitigate climate change, the five bullets were repairing ecosystems, increasing soil carbon, protecting open space, restoring degraded systems, and local food. And I thought, wow, these are things that Kivira Coalition's doing already. And I never realized there was actually a climate connection. So I said, what is this all about? So I read through the publication. And what they said was that through plant photosynthesis, which we all know about, you know, pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, the CO2 breaks off. That's carbon. The O2 is oxygen. It goes back out. The C goes lots of places within the plant, but a lot of it goes into the roots and then through the roots into the soil where it's stored. And the authors of this publication said, since there's so much grasslands around the world, potentially we could suck up a lot of CO2 through photosynthesis and grass, plants, and soils. I went, wow, I got to know more about this.
Now, if there's grasslands over the world, aren't they already doing that?
Yes. Well, you'd think so. Through our own experience, we knew that many grasslands are not as in healthy condition as they could be, that they're, some of them have been poorly managed over the years, over the decades, and a lot of that carbon that's stored in the soils has been lost through a lot of reasons. A lot of it to do with kind of land degradation, erosion, and not all of it cattle-related. It's just kind of how we treat land in general. And a lot of the scientists that I subsequently talked to and researched for this book say that it's kind of like a glass of water that has been sort of half of it's been poured out, and that's carbon in the soils. It's been lost for a lot of reasons. We have now the opportunity to refill that glass by better stewardship. We can put that carbon back into the soil that's been lost over these years. And so it's not just sort of jamming more carbon into the ground. It's actually refilling that glass that's now half full.
So basically restoring land to the way that it has traditionally been.
Right, right.
And what's interesting about this is that it's not just about leaving unpopulated open spaces, but it's compatible with farming and ranching.
Right, right. And so when I never thought about carbon before. You know, I never thought about carbon in the soils. But if anybody who's listening as a gardener, you understand what it is intuitively. You do a garden and you build it up over time, you do the right practices, that soil gets very dark and rich. That's carbon mostly. In fact, most soil, 58% of most soils, if they're healthy, is full of carbon. And so
it's carbon in compound. We're not talking about coal dust. Or
yes, carbon in compound. The sea, the element that bonds with all these things around the planet. It's part of every organic creature thing on the planet. It's got carbon in it. And so when you build carbon up in the soils through, adding organic matter, whatever, earthworms, you make it fluffy, stores more water, has nutrients in it, so it grows more plants. Now think of that scaling up to kind of large grasslands. If we could make more grasslands be like more gardens in your backyard, the potential for pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere becomes pretty large.
It's also very important in the context of the fact that there are a number of carbon sinks, like the ocean and the atmosphere and the forests, that are already full, basically.
Right.
They're already absorbing as much carbon as they can, and so we're kind of in trouble because of that, of the high level of CO2 that we are dumping into the air through burning, essentially, coal and other fossil fuels.
So the key here is the carbon cycle, and which is this great flow of carbon around the planet. Carbon is in biological things in the soil. It's also in rocks like limestone. It eventually leaks out, goes back in the atmosphere naturally. So we have carbon going up as CO2, and then it comes back down through this great cycle process. So it can go into oceans where it's absorbed. It can go into trees and shrubs where it's absorbed, or it can go into soils. And so those are the four great carbon sinks on the planet: atmosphere, oceans, vegetation, and soils. And that's kind of it. So if we want to have a healthy carbon cycle, all four of those need to not be full. They need to be, empty to some degree. So that carbon circles around. Well, we know what we're doing. We have pumped too much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So that sink is overflowing. The oceans, unfortunately, are filling up. And we don't want that. It has all kinds of bad effects. There's lots of trees, but there's not enough trees and vegetation to soak up all the excess CO2. So that leaves soils. And actually, the soil scientists say there's so much potential in soils to soak up CO2. We could really pull down the excessive amount of carbon dioxide we have currently. Now, it's easier said than done. There's lots of stuff to that, and that's what the book is about.
Well, and what's so great about the book, and by the way, it's just beautifully written. If anybody wants to read this book, it's called Grass, Soil, Hope, A Journey Through Carbon Country. You just feel like you're sitting at the breakfast table with Courtney having a conversation. It's just terrific. But what you do is you go to all of these different places and find people who are actually doing really interesting and innovative ways of, again, farming and ranching. And it's interesting to me because often there are people either who came back to it after a generation of being away and they've gone to the city and done other things, or there are people who are coming to it with new ideas like the greenhorns.
Right.
So there's a lot of kind of cross-pollination between the farming and ranching communities and the rest of the world.
Right. And part of it is for the last 30, 40 years, this wonderful toolbox has been developed by lots of different folks. So it's organic farming, it's no-till, it's cattle management, a lot of it's creek restoration activities. So everybody kind of in their own way has been working on this. The link then, as I try to describe in the book, is carbon and climate, because carbon is sort of literally the link, the glue that holds all these different things together. If you attach it to the climate problem that we've got, then suddenly lots of opportunities open up. So carbon traditionally is the bad guy, right? We got too much of it. We got this carbon pollution. We got this war on carbon. Suddenly it becomes the good guy in a different context. And I think a lot of the farmers and ranchers that I know used to think about it kind of the old way and start now thinking about the new way. And I wrote the book to try to reach a wider audience so we could think about carbon as a positive in our lives rather than simply just the negative that we all feel gloomy about day in and day out.
Yeah, carbon dioxide. I mean, this is the thing. If we're going to be careful with our language here, I mean, we're talking about carbon dioxide, we're talking about carbon, we're talking about carbon compounds, all of which are different things and behave differently.
Right.
But one of the takeaways for me from this book was approaching problems as opportunities.
Right, right.
And some of the folks are doing that. The first guy you visited in California, what was his name?
John Wick. Yeah, John really kind of opened my eyes. John Wick and Jeff Creek. And Jeff is an agroecologist that works with John. As I describe in the book, I was washing dishes in my kitchen in 2009. And I heard the story on NPR about a project in California called the Marin Carbon Project, where the landowner, John, and his wife had kicked all the cows off the land. They'd bought this little property north of San Francisco. And then it went to weeds. They're very concerned about the ecological health of it. They talked to Jeff. He said, the cows aren't the problem. Bring them back. Let's manage them differently. Let's turn this negative into a positive. Let's manage the land for health rather than for death. And he was spending a lot of time spraying and weeding and pulling because he really wanted to get rid of those weeds.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like, it's not about taking out the weeds. It's about making
right.
the land hospitable to the native grasses
right.
that like to live there
right.
and that will eventually outcompete the weeds
right.
and to some extent coexist with the weeds.
And the key to that is what's happening below the ground. And this is hard for us as humans because we like above ground, right? We're farmers, we're worried about the crops, we're ranchers, we're worried about the animals. If we're hikers, we're thinking about the trees. But the key to carbon sequestration, soils, and pretty much everything else that's in the book is what's happening below the surface of the ground. And my heroes are microbiologists. And in the last 20 years, they have explored this incredible universe in the soil. So it's all about biological life, the nematodes and the protozoas and the earthworms and the bacteria. When you have healthy soil full of life, all these wonderful things happen, including the carbon cycle works faster. So what Jeff told John was you need life in the soils. You need to stop killing that life down there with spraying and weeding and turn it around and do things that enhance life, bring it back. And John said, sure, I'll give it a try. And it went really well. And then they brought in a science team from UC Berkeley to measure what they were doing, and kind of on and on, they realized that there was actually a lot of good science behind the possibilities of carbon sequestration in soils.
One of the things that will probably be news to a lot of people is that plowing the soil,
right.
tilling the soil, might not be a very good idea.
Yeah, it was news to me, actually, when I began to do the research for this. I'd heard about the damage that plowing does to the below ground biological life that I just described. But I'm not a farmer. I don't have a farming background. I haven't worked a lot with farmers, so I wasn't quite sure what this all meant. So I went and did some research and talked to some no-till farmers, folks who are farming literally by not plowing, but not tilling the soil. So what I learned was when you plow, when you actually turn soil over, it kills all the life down there. All those bacteria, protozoas, whatever get turned over, they're exposed to heat and light and air and they die. Plow itself rips up mycorrhizal fungi, and those are the really good guys. The mycorrhizal fungi are the ones that are the carbon brokers in the soil between the plant roots and the minerals and everything else. They literally get torn to pieces by plows. And as I say in the book, there was a researcher back in the 50s who asked the kind of not-so-rhetorical question, has anybody found a scientific reason to till? And the answer is no.
And it's almost, but I mean, when we think about our mythologies of farmers, the
right.
humble farmer tilling the field, I mean,
right.
it goes back millennia.
Well, there's a hieroglyph image of a plow on an Egyptian temple wall. So that's 5,000 years ago.
Right.
And so we have this kind of ideology that we must till the soil. In fact, it disturbs that biological life down there, and then it depletes its fertility, and then you need chemicals, right, to bring that fertility back. All of that's bad for microbes. All that's bad for the carbon cycle. So there's been a movement in the last couple decades towards no-till agriculture, and this is just what it sounds like. It's It's planting seeds and soils with a no-till drill, which makes a very narrow groove through the land, doesn't turn it over, drops the seeds in it, and uses a cover crop of some sort to cover the soil, and up comes the cash crop through the cover crop. It's been adopted by some big farms, corn and soybean stuff, and they use pesticides in conjunction with it to hold down weeds, because tilling is good for weeds. But what I describe in the book is the organic no-till idea, which is coming out of Rodale, which is in Pennsylvania, the idea of how do we do no-till organically. And I use a farmer, Dorn Cox, who's in New Hampshire, who has adopted all these practices successfully. And he looks at organic no-till as sort of the holy grail of agriculture, because it combines all these wonderful things. And I should say quickly, Dorn's coming to our conference again to speak this fall.
Ah,
so it kind of give us an update on what's going on.
Excellent. Yeah, and he's one of those people who decided to get off the land, became like a financial guy, a systems analyst and whatever, and just decided, you know, I need to go back to my farm and do things, first of all, just to be there and farm, but to do things differently, and actually was able to use his systems analyst approach to dealing with the farm as a complex system. And I think this is another one of the themes of the book, is that you are dealing, when you are farming and when you are ranching, you're essentially dealing with ecosystems as opposed to dealing with monocrops if you're going to do it in a sustainable way.
Right. Yeah, and Dorn represents kind of a new generation of farmers and ranchers, which I also describe later in the book. It's absolutely exciting, energizing to hang out with these folks and see kind of what's on their minds. And so Dorn, for example, who is in his 30s, as you say, he went to Wall Street, then he went to high tech and came back to the farm, and he brought the skill set back. So he's not just his farming skills, but complexity theory, open source software. They built a biodiesel truck. All of it's shared democratically. So a lot of young folks today have obviously kind of high tech abilities, but they have that kind of old school farming wedded to it, and then they bring a lot of business savvy to it. So it's a very interesting group to talk to. Climate change, for example, is not, as they've grown up with it, thinking about it. So they're thinking about carbon, they're thinking about their carbon footprints. Dorn runs most his farm on biodiesel, trying to get off petroleum. It's exciting to see all these different things in the toolbox that I described a little bit earlier now being implemented by young farmers and ranchers today.
There are also people doing very innovative things right here in New Mexico, although climate change is, what do you call it, the problem that shall not be named?
Well, yeah. In the ranching community, as well as other communities, it's something that still is politically charged. And so we sort of talk about it without talking about it, I guess. So.
What are some of the things that people are doing here in New Mexico?
Well, in the book, I profile Craig Sponholz, who is a restorationist. He spends most of his time working in creeks, restoring them. He's also an artist by training, so he builds these beautiful structures. And so that highlights kind of the work going on in New Mexico on the ecological side, because it's not just about farming and ranching. It's also about how we restore these damaged landscapes, particularly the water cycle, and in the drought that we've got going on, where the water comes from, how much of it there is going to become increasingly critical. And when you increase carbon in soils, it holds more water. It just got greater water holding capacity, and this is great. And what Craig does is fix damaged creeks, and he does it using a bioengineering approach. I won't go into all the details. But as those creeks come back and repair themselves and get restored, there's more green vegetation, there's more carbon in the soils, there's more water, all that fun stuff. And New Mexico is definitely on the leading edge of that kind of work. There's been a lot of creek healing over the years here. Quivira has been part of it, but it's a larger community than that. And it's neat now to see, as I travel around, those ideas spread to other states.
You also went to New Zealand, no, to Australia,
right,
where there's some interesting work going on. Now, I think that was the place where they were grazing sheep and cattle together.
Right.
The flock and the herd put together are called
a flurd. Right.
Not to mention kangaroos jumping around.
Yeah, you know, it's funny to go down there and drive around with these farmers. They don't call them ranchers, even though they have only livestock, and see these kangaroos just everywhere. And everybody's ignoring them except me. I'm looking out the window going, wow, kangaroos. And there's so many of them. In fact, some folks consider them to be pests of a sort, not the ranchers, farmers that we worked with. But they were just, yeah, kangaroos. So I'm fascinated. I'm looking at the world. Look at that one. There's a kangaroo. And they're like, yeah, another kangaroo. So I went to Australia at the invitation of Christine Jones, who's a soil scientist. She's also speaking at our conference this fall. She was really a pioneer on the science side of soil carbon. She has worked very closely with some landowners, two of which I profile in the book, particularly a man named Colin Seiss, who is a sheep farmer, but he also grows crops in his pasture, and this is called pasture cropping. It was an idea I had never heard of when I first met Christine, and I won't go into all the details, but basically he grows an annual crop through his pasture. He no-till drills it in the winter. It grows up, he harvests that crop, but then he turns the sheep out, and it's all done very symbiotically. He's got good cattle management. What he has found is that nature likes to have annuals and perennials grow together, which, if anybody knows, you know, grow a crop, you got to weeds, right? So weeds, and he said, we have a culture that separates crops from pasture, keeps them as separate, and he said, let's put them together. The chapter is called Coexistence. How do we get these two crops, in a sense, to grow symbiotically? And the exciting part of that is that you can feed more people this way. And we've got a larger population ultimately to feed. What Colin is doing, he's got a food crop and a pasture crop in the same acre or number of acres. So he's able to sort of vertically stack what he does, food production. It's sustainable. It improves the carbon content of the soil. It's got all these great benefits. And it's spread in Australia. They now 2,000 farms are pasture cropping. It's an idea that's starting to get some momentum in other places. It's not done in America very much that I'm aware of. We still have that paradigm where we have crops over here, we have animals over here, we keep them separate. When in fact, there's an old saying in organic agriculture that nature never farms without an animal. And so that's what Colin does.
Well, and if you think about it, I mean, I think one of the takeaways from this book also is that nature has no fences. Things all evolved together, and they all tend to have relationships with each other.
Right.
So you've got something that is food growing, and you've got herbivore cattle types of animals, whether they're cows or whether they're bison or whatever, running around, and they're actually all working within the same system. And I think, I mean, it seems like the world is kind of dividing into those who think we can solve our problems through technology and those who think we can solve our problems by looking at the way nature does things and
That's
going
right.
that way. And you seem to take the second approach, which is a much more low-tech approach.
It is it's a highly low-tech approach. And what's so exciting about it is that we don't have to invent anything. And these are practices that have been around for a long time. Photosynthesis has been around for, billions of years. So we know actually how to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and store it in plants and soils. Some of these practices went away for a while. Industrial agriculture really kind of took hold. Herding, for example, integrating animals into food production sustainably. Now these ideas have come back. They've been well developed. That toolbox has been well figured out. Now we know some good science kind of behind it. But you're absolutely right. The world is kind of separating. I don't know if you saw the news today. The first international geoengineering conference for the climate is happening right now in Berlin.
Yeah.
And these are a group of scientists who are trying to figure out how to address climate change through geoengineering schemes. This is high-tech, kind of spooky stuff about throwing sulfates into the ocean or mirrors up in the sky. The question we have to ask ourselves, do we really think that's the answer to these problems? Is more high-tech, geo-engineered solutions? Or do we look at what has worked for a long time, photosynthesis, animals, grass, those kinds of things? And so I come down pretty hard on the nature side of this. Nature still has the best ideas. Humans still think that they know best, and so we have this kind of split now that is a problem because the crisis is growing on us, right?
It seems also that, chapter after chapter, it seemed like not only are you describing ways of doing land stewardship, but you're also describing kind of metaphors for getting along with each other.
Right. Yeah, and that's deliberate because we can talk all day about practices and about the science and about the chemistry, but ultimately it's about relationships. It's about how we treat each other, how we treat animals, how we treat the land. Do we treat ourselves, each other poorly? Do we treat each other exploitatively? Or do we find a way to get along together? And so every chapter has something to say about those relationships, whether it's sort of directly animals or directly to soils, but fundamentally it's about how humans treat each other. In the first chapter, John had this sort of attitude that everything was a problem that had to be solved, and we had to kind of strong arm our way through this. And he had a bad relationship with his, his plants and the weeds, and he was using chemicals. And then we turned it around and said, "No, let's look for the positive relationship here." And once you do that, all kinds of opportunities open up. It feels maybe a little touchy feely, I guess, in a certain way. But what's neat about carbon is that it's got chemistry and science and practices kind of related to it, and then it's got the art part. I talk about art in a chapter, how we view things, how we look at landscapes, because it's all bunched up together. You can't separate them out.
Well, for example, one of the metaphors that people use that we don't think about being a plant metaphor is when people talk about rooting out the bad guys, which is really kind of like the chapter on weeding and how Right. It's not really about taking out the weeds or rooting out the bad guys, but having a bigger ecosystem
picture,
in which
Right. Those
folks coexist with each other, Right. And one doesn't dominate the other.
Right. Well, somebody said weeds are just a plant out of place. It's just a plant, but we attach the word weed to it, and we have to get rid of it, and we have to eradicate it. But in fact, it may have a positive role here. It all depends really on our attitudes, and that's what happened to John Wick. He flipped his attitude. He didn't really change anything else other than he was looking at his land differently. And that happened to me. One of the reasons why we started the Kavir Coalition was that I met a rancher who just had a different attitude. He was trying to get along with animals, the government employees, everything like that, and it worked. He saw health flowed from a positive attitude rather than looking at everything destructively or negatively or feeling gloomy about things. Now, I need to add that what's in the book is hopeful, and I see a lot of hope. It's also some challenges that lie in front of us, how to scale these things up, how to get past some of the economic challenges, some of the institutional challenges to make this work. I profile a number of cool kind of case studies, folks doing really cool stuff, but people have asked me, Courtney, well, how do we take this up to a level that matters? And that, that becomes a difficult question. There's lots of things that, folks listening understand are in the way of progress. Organic farming, what's in the way of organic farming? Well, industrial farming, those kinds of things.
And a lot of regulations that promote industrial farming and that inhibit organic farming.
Right. And at the end of the book, I do a little kind of sort of free speculation about how we would make an economy out of this. We got these practices, we know the role of carbon, we can think about the carbon cycle and the atmosphere, but fundamentally this has to be about working economically at some level, and we're not there yet. A lot of folks are thinking about this. How do you pay a landowner to increase soil carbon directly or indirectly? What if we had a carbon tax, heaven forbid, which would then reduce the emissions on the front side, and maybe that created a pool of money to pay folks to rehabilitate or restore their land to put carbon in their... what if I paid you, we entered into a contract, and I paid you a chunk of money to double the soil carbon in your land. I left it to you to figure out. Well, you'd figure something out, and I'd pay you, and there'd be more carbon in the soils, and we all would be in better shape. So it's hopeful, but also there's still some challenges, some pretty big challenges in front of us. But I just kind of wanted to stimulate that whole conversation with this book.
Yeah, I think we have to change. We have to evolve as a culture. Part of this is just cultural change, letting go of the way that we have done things and letting new ways come into being without destroying the old completely necessarily.
Right. And that's, and I feel a sense of urgency. I feel that there are things going on in the world that, climate in particular, that, we have this toolbox. How do we get it implemented more quickly? And I don't know what the answer to these are. I'm hoping to kind of dig into this maybe in the next project. But it's hopeful to find these practices and think about carbon and put them out there and see. And it's been a lot of positive reaction. Folks understand the potentials here, I believe.
And it's just simply a wonderful book. It's really fun to read. It's called Grass, Soil, Hope: A Journey Through Carbon Country by Courtney White, with a foreword by the wonderful Michael Pollan.
I was very blessed that he agreed to do that. I'm very honored.
Courtney White will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Sunday, the 24th of August at 11 in the morning, talking about the book and hopefully engaging in conversation with anybody who comes.
Absolutely. I want to talk with the audience and kind of see what's on their minds and see how we can push all this forward.
And it's part of the Journey Santa Fe series. Courtney White, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Good to see you.